In an abandoned underground city at the Spanish coast near Malaga, I found a USB stick containing 300 random movies, from arthouse to weird, from obscure to notorious. Now, in lockdown, it is time to watch and discuss them all in an international podcast project. Two Turks and a German, two filmmakers and a mystery man. Welcome to Mysterium Pictorum. Welcome, welcome to Mysterium Pictorum. This time we watched the movie No Country for Old Men by the Coen Brothers. And once again, this episode, we are recording all three of us together in one room. It's a miracle. And not only are the three of us together in one room, no, we also have a guest also in the same room. Can you believe that? Yes, COVID tests were involved in the process that led to this point. But before we talk about anything else, who are we? And I think our guest should go first. We are good hosts. Doruk, who are you?
Hello. I'm Doruk. I'm a random guy they picked off the street to talk about movies. I was told that this is too professional, so they told me to be the voice of the people.
Yes, exactly. I am here. Because we're always like, it's this stuck up academic podcast. It's too high minded for the man on the street.
Yes. We had PhD people. So.
You need a layman to complement the process. Yes.
Yeah. What do the plebs think about this?
So you might give us that perspective. Nisan, who are you?
I am Nisan. And... well, we are in Turkey for the first time. I mean, Lars and me. Maybe I thought that's interesting. Not for the first time. I mean, the podcast recording is for the first time somewhere else, but our apartment in Hamburg/Germany. And that's exciting.
So that's who you are, Jan. Who are you?
I'm Jan, and that's all you need to know.
And I am Lars Henriks, writer-director from Hamburg, Germany.
Famous writer-director from Germany.
Let's say visionary. Okay, let's talk about the movie. I think these introduction rounds get worse and worse every time.
Because at some point, I don't know what to tell anymore.
Just have a catchphrase.
Tell them how you like to pee.
Oh, our Mysterium Pictorum audience doesn't know it yet. Maybe we can reveal that I'm pregnant.
So we're going to have one listener more.
Yes!
Making our own audience.
Yeah, well, that's a new fact about me. That's why I have to pee a lot.
Do you know the father?
I guess there are some options. We'll see how it looks like.
Yeah, that's going to be interesting. Let's see how this shapes up. So we did watch No Country for Old Men. Not only are we recording this podcast, the four of us in the same room. No, we also just watched this movie right here, right in this room. The four of us while eating Mante, which was delicious. We also had a mount of Turşu, which was also delicious. We bought that today. Jaren brought us to a shop that sold exclusively turşu, which was impressive to me.
For the Turkish audience, they thought they could eat 1.5 kilos of turşu in 2 days.
We didn't think. We didn't think. We were just in that shop and everything looked great, so we bought it.
Sure.
Like, that's what you do.
I mean, I brought foreign currency to our country, people.
Yes. So he's really doing the work for a simple man from the street like you, Doruk.
I mean, I think you should definitely vlog this attempt of them eating 1.5 kilos of turşu over the next 2 days.
All right. So that's how we watched it. Is there anything to add to the way we watched it? We watched this on a television at Jaren's home, and it was nice.
Undisclosed location.
In an undisclosed location somewhere in the world. I think if none of you wants to add anything to this
riveting story of how we watched this movie. We could move on to the next point on the agenda. How did we like it? Doruk, how did you like it?
I liked it quite a lot. I think it lives up to its hype.
Yeah, I think so too. Absolutely. Yaren?
I watched this before. How did you like it?
No, Yaren. Last night, you told me you watched this before and you hated it. Now, we watched this and I think you, like, explain yourself.
Okay, I watched this when first came out. I didn't like it. I didn't recommend it to anyone since then. And rewatching it by, like, half point, I thought, why didn't I like this? This is pretty good. And it's before Game of Thrones with all that twists and shit. But yeah, the ending, so I'm like, I would give it out maybe 6.
The Coen brothers problem, one might say, in a way. But let's talk about that some more later. Nissan, how did you like it?
I don't think it's the Coen brothers problem. It's the Coen brothers style.
Yeah, you call it style. I call it a problem. So, Nissan, how did you like it?
I like it too. I also watched it for the second time. First time is years ago. I couldn't remember everything from the movie because of the Coen brothers style and because I was much younger, but I really liked it again.
Me too. I absolutely loved it. I think there was so much to appreciate here. It did confuse me the way, like Coen brothers films often do this thing where they are over and I'm like, huh? Like what was this?
Anticlimactic endings.
Yeah, and oftentimes like anticlimactic storylines too. But this one did have like a pretty conventional storyline, and I had more of a grasp on why it was anticlimactic in the ways that it was. Maybe we can talk about that later too. I really, really like this. So let me, before we get into this in more detail, try to sum up the story. I've just watched this, so no idea. I did sum up the story of Alice on Acid once. So
you have.
I should be able to do this. In the beginning, I think, we meet a psychopath with a great haircut played by Javier Bardem. There's a voiceover. We decided on that voiceover being spoken by Tommy Lee Jones. I think we discussed for a bit, but I think it was Tommy Lee Jones. So he tells us something, whatever. It's the desert, and a psychopath goes around randomly killing people while enjoying it. He has great authority doing it, and like he's very, very relaxed, and he has lots of swagger to boast. Then we meet a guy who hunts game, and while he does that, he sees many, many dead people. There has apparently been a shootout. He goes to those people. One of them is still alive, sitting in a car. It was apparently about drugs, and that one living person asks for water, to which our shitty protagonist says, and doesn't give him any, and then asks him where the one surviving person of the shootout is. I wanted to do the southern accent in this podcast, but listening to it, I had a lot of fun imitating it. Right now, I couldn't do it. I don't know how it's like. It would just
you lost your mojo.
Yeah. I'm gonna fail, so I'm not gonna attempt. He then goes after the one person that survived the shootout. That one person hasn't survived for long. He's dead, lying around somewhere close to the shooting location. But he has taken a suitcase full of money with him. And apparently, with one glance at the money, our shit protagonist decides this is $2 million. So he takes it. $2 million, great. He goes home to his wife. At night, he decides, no, I cannot leave that poor person without water. I will go back and bring him water. So he goes back to bring the guy water. The guy is gone or dead. We don't see him. But new guys arrive. They have light. They shoot at our shit protagonist. They slash his tires. So our shit protagonist now has to run from them. He is being shot at. He gets hurt. He throws himself into a river. A pit bull goes after him. He outswims the pit bull, then shoots the pit bull right the second that pit bull was lunging at his head to kill him. Dead dogs being a topic in this movie. He goes back to his wife and sends his wife away to safety, I think. He tells her about the $2 million and he says, you go to safety and I will meet you somewhere. Now, our psychopath has a legendary scene in which he lets a coin toss decide whether or not he will kill a shopkeeper. A great scene, fantastic. There's lots of great scenes between two actors in this movie. And there are great actors in this movie who have like two scenes, but two long scenes. For example, Woody Harrelson, who we then see he gets employed by a mysterious employer. We don't know who, a person with money who wants to have those $2 million. And he now sends Woody Harrelson to go get that psychopath. And like many people are after this money now. Right? Right.
As you would. Yeah, after $2 million.
$2 million, I'd be in the running too. From now on, things get a bit murky for me. Our protagonist, he tries to escape. He finds out the money has a tracker in it. The psychopath finds him due to said tracker. He then finds the, I say tracker, but I don't even know if this is a word. Tracking device, the thing, the whatever in his suitcase. He finds it, but instead of putting it somewhere and running, he puts it next to himself and waits. What an idiot. He doesn't die yet. He doesn't die yet. He somehow escapes the psychopath, but it is very close. He takes a car from a guy who gets shot and everybody is dead all the time. And he makes it across the Mexican border, but he's badly hurt. He then goes to a hospital.
Medico.
Yeah, medico. He says medico. He waves with money at people and they bring him to hospital. The psychopath, meanwhile, what does he do? The psychopath does a great thing. And I will try this. Like, if you want to go to a pharmacy and you want to have something that they are likely not going to give you, this is how you do it. He burns a car in front of the pharmacy. He makes the car explode while he goes into the pharmacy. So while everybody, of course, naturally runs outside to look at the burning car, he just casually goes into the pharmacy and gets everything he wants. I will definitely try this. This is a life hack. Perfect. Thank you, Coen Brothers. So then he stitches himself up. Doruk was saying very observantly, the bad guys always know how to
patch themselves up. Yeah. They know first aid. They know what to do. So they're great in that regard.
Good self-doctors. Now he still goes after our guy. Our guy gets a visit from Woody Harrelson. Woody Harrelson offers him safety and even a part of the money. Our guy says no. Woody Harrelson then goes, finds the money, I think, but doesn't take it.
I didn't understand why.
It was inconvenient. It was far away. It was somewhere in the bushes. Why would you inconvenience yourself for $2 million? He then goes to some hotel where the psychopath finds him. He offers the psychopath $14,000, but gets shot anyway. Poor Woody Harrelson. He was great, right? But more on that later. Then our... wait, what happened?
Then, I mean, is that when we had the shootout between our protagonist and the psychopath, or was that before?
That was before. Ah, no. Now the psychopath and the protagonist, they talk to each other on the phone.
Yes.
The protagonist gets a chance to save his wife because the psychopath says, I know where your wife is. I'm going to kill your wife if you don't give me the money. If you give me the money, I will just kill you and your wife is safe. And our protagonist says, no. No to that. He then calls his wife and says to his wife that they will meet at a hotel somewhere in Mexico, I think.
Yeah, El Paso.
Yeah.
His wife then takes her mother and they make their way there to said hotel. And on their way, they tell some random Mexicans in suits where they are going. Now, our shit protagonist arrives at the hotel, flirts with a woman, wants to drink some beers with her and says he knows where beers lead to. There's a cut to black, and when we see him again, he's dead. Thank you, Coen Brothers. He's dead. The woman is dead. He's found. Apparently, there has been a shootout done by Mexicans. The psychopath. I don't even know if he has the money yet. Then there's Tommy Lee Jones. I haven't mentioned Tommy Lee Jones yet because he hasn't been very instrumental to the story. But Tommy Lee Jones.
He didn't do shit.
Yeah, right. But he's a cop who's also there. And he now finds the corpse and goes into a hotel room in which the psychopath is too. And then he goes out again. Thank you, Coen Brothers. Now, a couple of months later, the wife buries her mother. which is sad for her. She then goes home and is killed by the psychopath, which is even more sad for her. The psychopath now goes out and he's in a random car accident, breaking his arm. The bone sticks out, as a kid points out again and again. Thank you, Coen Brothers. Then the Tommy Lee Jones character has a monologue about how he has dreams of his father. The end.
Yes, and he retires.
And he retires. Okay.
He doesn't know what to do with his life anymore.
Yeah. And his wife doesn't want him around.
Yeah, he's all sad.
Yeah, it's getting tragic at that point.
You got more out of this scene than I did. Because you're closer to retirement.
I just heard I'm 1,400 days away from retirement.
That's so depressing.
How did you hear that? What?
If you were a proper Turkish citizen, you could too. Online.
Okay, you can find out.
Mm-hmm.
Really?
Yeah.
But not if you're a freelancer like me, yeah, for example. But freelancer don't
anyway,
retire.
Let's keep this portion out.
Okay, Dorek, you chose this movie out of the list we presented you with. Why?
Okay, pretty simple. I'm the layman here. So that was in your obscure list of movies. That was the only one that sounded familiar and I wanted to see it. So that's why I chose it.
That makes perfect sense. Actually, it is one of the least obscure movies on the Drive.
I think so, yeah. It was pretty linear. Everything happened almost for a reason.
Yeah. And like there were known actors in this. The Coen brothers are known entities. Like maybe this episode will get some hits because, you know, people will maybe look for a podcast where people talk about No Country for Old Men.
And then learn about Turkish, I don't know, social security system.
Yaren, this morning we had a brief discussion about horror and the definition of horror. So when this movie started, you sort of facetiously, I shouldn't use words that I cannot pronounce. You asked...
it adds to the appeal of the podcast.
Right.
People say you sound like a cartoon frog.
Well, I take that as a compliment. Fuck you, people.
Write it as an iTunes review.
5-star one, please. So, when this movie started, you said, is this a horror movie? And I read a book by Lloyd Kaufman. I actually read several books by Lloyd Kaufman, so I do not know which...
Why do you keep posting about the amount of books you read?
Because that is a thing that I think is worth boasting with. Shut up and leave me alone.
Not for the people who never read books.
Not for the layman, it isn't.
Yeah, like, see, he's not impressed.
But the kind of people this podcast is supposed to attract will be very impressed and will put up a Lars wall in their room and keep track of the books that I am recommending and keep buying them to...
That could be someone else's Mysterium Pictorum list.
Oh, yes, a podcast.
Mysterium Littlorum.
Yes, a podcast about all the books I talk about. No, Lloyd Kaufman... For the layman, Doruk, Lloyd Kaufman is the boss of Trauma Entertainment from New York. They made such films as The Toxic Avenger. You familiar?
No.
Okay, good. The Toxic Avenger is, I think, their most famous thing. Mother's Day they made too, and they sort of deteriorated into very eccentric, underground, no budget fare. But they are the longest running independent film studio in the world, and Lloyd Kaufman is sort of like a cult figure in the film industry, I guess. People love him. And he wrote several books about making movies. First one is called All I Need to Know About Filmmaking I Learned from the Toxic Avenger. It was written by James Gunn. It says it was written by Lloyd Kaufman, but actually James Gunn wrote it. So it's an entertaining read. James Gunn started his career working for Lloyd Kaufman. He wrote the film Romeo and Juliet in 1996. It's a trauma movie, cashing in on Romeo and Juliet. It's actually really good. We should watch it. There's a penis monster in it. There's an actual nipple piercing being filmed. It's fantastic. It's really good. Lloyd Kaufman said, in like one of his books, he opens with, so recently the Oscars took place, and the Coen brothers, or something about No Country for Old Men, was nominated. And he then went on to say that that movie worked according to the rules of slasher horror movies that he and others had helped to establish during the 70s and 80s. And he took some of the credit for the success of the movie and the existence of the movie. And now, I love Lloyd Kaufman dearly, but I call bullshit. Even I would not call this a horror film. Like, yes, there is a psychopathic killer in this who is after people, but is this, in your mind, a slasher movie?
I think it was a Western movie, actually.
Yeah, definitely. I think it was clearly Western.
I mean, I think we could find a couple genres which would fit to the movie. But no, it was not a horror movie. It was too random. The killings happened too random.
Well, horror movies are random too.
Well, yeah, I mean,
always have a reason and revenge, and it's always a backstory. And
but Jason Voorhees doesn't have a reason for killing. Okay, revenge, mother, blah blah. But he's like personified horror, death.
Horror is more like psychological drama, and this was more Coen brothers being nihilists again.
So you would say that Friday the 13th, part 5, was more psychological than No Country for Old Men?
I've never watched Friday the 13th, none of them.
Me neither.
I don't mean that the movie is not psychological.
I've seen the first two.
I didn't mean the movie is not psychological. I mean the motives, the build-up. I think horror is different.
That being said, and I agree, and I don't think this is a horror movie, but they could have very easily turned this into a horror movie because it had a lot of the elements there, I think. So that's probably why people do, or at least, you know, the person that you attributed this to claim some credit to it, because there are quite a lot of elements in there that could very well, very easily become a horror movie, but it hasn't. It's a completely different direction that they took with it.
I think specifically that they gave their killer a monetary interest in his murder spree. That made it non-horror because there was like a clear worldly motive behind his killing. And then, like, in the beginning, he was some sort of an unstoppable force and people were talking about him like that. And had he remained that, that would have been cool. But then there were scenes in which he was like crying, he got hurt pretty early on.
Was he crying? No, I don't think he was crying.
Yeah.
There were tears, so that's crying. I know in Turkey, maybe you don't think so.
I didn't even see the tears though.
Yeah.
But his eyes were glittering like a little girl's eyes.
Always open. He's always alert. That's why.
He was a little cry baby, and you just don't want to admit it.
Cats don't cry.
Let's talk about cats a little later. No, okay. He got hurt. We saw him patch himself up, and he pretty early on didn't seem so invincible anymore. And I think that had he remained invincible, had he remained an enigma, had he remained sort of borderline supernatural, like they wouldn't have needed to go all the way, but like played with it a little more like they did in the beginning. And had he not been after money, but maybe just beside the whole money plot, been just there killing people for kicks, like he seemed to do anyway, then I would definitely argue this is at least a horror Western.
Yeah.
But it wasn't that way, so I think it wasn't.
Perfect Western thriller.
I don't know if this was a thriller, but I don't know if this was a thriller. Because TH is a hard thing to say for a German. Plus, I think thriller is a...
is that why you don't want to recognize it as a genre?
Thriller is a bullshit genre that boring normies in the 90s made up to not say they're into horror, because they thought people will think I'm silly, but I'm wearing Armani suits and doing coke, so I'm a real grown-up. So American Psycho is a thriller. Plus, I'm excluding Germans from film discussion. It's a thriller.
Got so silent.
You're evil people. I will cut this out. This isn't horror, we say. This is a Western. So I have not much experience with Westerns. this might have been one of the first Westerns I've consciously watched. Maybe Western is even a genre that I avoid. A couple of weeks ago, I found in one of those giveaway bookshelves that I love to frequent in Germany. Jaren, did I show you mine? Yeah, it's a great one. I found a Western collection, like 10 or 20, Western movies. Western movies. So some Western fan must have died. Several classics I've never heard of, but like famous actors in there. So I'm looking forward to experiencing the genre. You guys, do you have more? I don't know. Do you have more experience than me with Westerns?
No, I watched 3-4 Westerns, I think, and the second season of Preacher, which was also Western-y.
I mean, still, I think we talked about this before because Bakurao was a sort of Western movie.
Yeah, right.
We talked about the subgenre of Weird West, which is like any other genre. Yeah, for example, any genre in combination with Western. So like horror Western would be Weird West, sci-fi Western like Wild Wild West, or Bakurao was that. Or
I think this was more pessimistic Western, like. Or that could be the term of the week. I don't know.
Pessimistic Western. Yeah, I like that. Or nihilistic even.
Mm-hmm. Or maybe post-Western.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it's also the all times are changing is a part of the narrative of the movie, you know, Tommy
Lee
Jones.
But it's also taking place in the 80s, so it's already old times.
Yeah, sort of. But he's a sheriff that's trying to deal with, you know, a drug shootout now. So he's still a Western character. But the crime that he's dealing with, you know, a drug shootout, a psychopath, is so not Western. It's not the gangs of old, you know, meeting outside of a saloon on a midday, you know, blah, blah, blah. So it's not that typical type of crime, but it's still the same old sheriff trying to fight against it.
Taking out the locks.
Yep.
So he wants the old Western doors.
Maybe.
Oh, yes, to swing. Doruk, what's your story with Westerns?
I mean, I watched quite a lot of them back in the day with my grandfather because he used to love them. But I haven't watched any in recent years, or at least any in you know, consciously. I would just watch them with my grandfather as a kid, so I don't know what else to say on that. How about you, Jaren?
I what the fuck? I told you this before. I hate Westerns. This horrible. Maybe that's why I didn't like it the first time I seen this.
Because it was a Western.
Yeah.
Okay, so my next question will not be one that you like, but are there Westerns that you guys can recommend?
Preacher season 3.
Oh, I haven't seen that actually. Preacher is Weird West. Yes, that's what you said. Yeah. Yeah. I read the comic books. Did you read Preacher?
No.
No, I haven't.
You should read Preacher. It's good. It's really good. Okay, so Preacher, I guess, is a recommendation. Doruk, you seem to have the most experience with Westerns. As the layman, can you recommend a Western?
I mean, I can't think of any now, but The Ballad of Buster Scruggs was a movie that Coen Brothers did for Netflix. That's also a Western. And I thought it had a few good shorts there. Not the entire thing, but some of the stories it told were quite good.
Actually. Also, that too, like, since you mentioned it, the problem with them in almost all of their stories is that it like goes up and up and up, but doesn't really deliver anything. They work better at shorts. If you haven't seen that Ballad of Buster Scruggs, it's pretty good.
So the Coen brothers like their Westerns and return to the genre every now and then?
Maybe, yeah. Because they grew up with Western movies as apple pie Americans.
Let's talk a bit about the Coen brothers. So we kept saying this, the Coen brothers, they do this often, this anticlimactic thing, this I don't know, post-narrative thing. And I was saying this before we recorded. For example, when I watched Inside Llewyn Davis, the whole time that I watched the movie, it left me cold. Until like afterwards, I was so sort of unsatisfied with the movie that I kept thinking about it until suddenly I thought, oh, wow, wait, this was about grief. This was about a person who had been part of a country duo. And before the movie started, the other person had died. And now this whole movie was about this man trying to find his place alone in the world. And since they hadn't given us the context, really, only in like in dialogue with people and hinting here and there, to me, maybe I was just younger and even more stupid when I watched it. To me, it didn't feel apparent. I didn't make the connection. But once I made it, the movie really felt really profound to me. And since I had to think about it so much to get that, it felt all the closer to me. I had a similar experience with A Simple Man. Felt less profound to me, but it just took me a while to see that, okay, this is the Book of Job. And I think this happens sometimes with Coen Brothers movies. I must admit, I haven't seen all of them. Which are your favorite Coen Brothers movies?
I was just thinking about what you said. I know what you mean. I think Coen Brothers are mostly run by the characters, but they are really cynical to their characters, and I think that's what can like leave you cold. But I also think, for example, in my head, I just compared them to Ari Aster, who's also very cynical to his characters, but he's also very disrespectful to his characters.
Ari Aster is a sadist in a way.
Yes. And Coen Brothers are, as I perceive it, like Javier Bardem in this movie. He was never disrespectful to the people he killed. Not in a sadistic way.
He was watching them die with pleasure.
He was cynical, but he was not like making, waiting them to humiliate themselves. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but he was bored of it. That's why he kept saying, everybody says this and that.
I think I know what you mean, but I disagree. Like, for example, the guy he made to decide in the coin toss, he made that guy humiliate himself. He made that guy deliberately...
He made him confused. But he didn't pee his pants off. He didn't scream and yell.
Yeah, maybe he would have if he had decided that it was tails, not heads.
Then he would kill him very fast. Like the Coen Brothers. My favorite Coen Brothers movie was, I think, Burn After Reading. It was a very cute movie. I liked it. It was funny.
Jan.
I don't know. I'm surprised I've seen most of their movies. I don't know. I watched that many. I'm just going to say Big Lebowski.
Oh, everybody says that. That's the normie answer.
I like it. What can I do?
Okay, why do you like it? I've seen The Big Lebowski. I've seen it on a plane. I was kind of happy to see it there because people have been hyping it up for years at the point that I had watched it. It was one of these movies that I refuse to watch because everybody says they are great. And then most of the times when I watch them, they are actually great.
I watch it without knowing anything about it. And then it's really impressive because the cast is great. The story is perfect. It shows a good balance between nihilism and pessimism. It's a good movie. It's fun.
I found it so boring.
Because you don't smoke weed.
That's true. And I think that's true, yes. Okay, so it's not made for me. Doruk, what's your favorite Coen Brothers movie?
I haven't seen most of them, looking at the list now. I have seen the TV series Fargo, but not the actual movie. The TV series I loved. And I think they were involved in the TV series as well.
Yeah, the
first season, I think.
Yeah. I love the first season of Fargo. Yes,
exactly. I love the first season as well.
And the what's his name again? The Billy Bob Thornton character. He was very similar to Javier Bardem in this, right?
Yeah, exactly.
That was a bit closer to horror actually than this one, because I think in the first season at least they kind of left the door open to like, or is he the Antichrist?
Yeah, but even there, you know, they have elements of horror, but it's guised in this stupidity and silliness and the randomness of things. And here as well, it's, you know, you have horror elements, but it's not a horror.
By the way, those horror elements, since you just said that, I think, could you click on what they edited? Because I think they started as editors for Sam Raimi on Evil Dead 2. They didn't. I will cut this out. Okay, whatever. So there's, I think there's often horror in their stuff. True Grit is another Western film, right? I haven't seen
it. Yeah, it's a remake. It's shit.
Burn After Reading, Nissan Loves. Nissan, we watched that 2 or 3 times, right?
I watched it a couple times. I showed it 2 times because the first time you didn't understand it. And I hated it that you didn't like it. So you had to like it. So I showed it again to you.
I think I completely forgot it.
Okay, it's about... Well, we're not going to talk about another movie now.
No. Okay. It's just that I realized I've watched a couple of their movies, but I've forgot many. I couldn't even tell you what my specific problem with The Big Lebowski was, apart from it was boring, because I forgot most of it. I don't usually forget movies, but now looking at the titles, I forget Coen Brothers movies.
Coen Brothers movies you have to watch again and again. But Burn After Reading was actually... Like the structure was like No Country for Old Men. Everyone died at the end, and it was a very random and, you know, abrupt ending, but it was more warm and funny, and it was about something else.
Lady Killers too, right? I watched Lady Killers when I was pretty young, and I remember it bothered me. I think it's a remake too, and I think also Everybody Dies, and Everybody Dies randomly. So that's the thing they do.
Yes.
Fuckers. Okay. So, Jaren, you've been to the south of the US. And since the south of the US is such an... it's almost like a character in this movie.
Sorry to interrupt. This movie also reminded me of, since you say south of the US, Winterspawn.
I haven't seen Winterspawn.
No, I haven't either.
Okay, then it's... Anyway.
But it did remind Nissan of it. Jaren, you've been to the
south of the US. I've seen as the whitest south of the US, so it doesn't really apply to this one.
But many people in this movie.
And I mean, since it takes place in the 80s, I guess they didn't need even an ID card to pass through the customs and border.
Well, he didn't. He just said where he was serving in Vietnam.
So it's a time before this time.
Yeah.
I wouldn't know how it looked like. Or if you went there now, it wouldn't feel the same, I'm sure.
Okay, so no comment of value there.
Okay,
all right.
Fuck you.
The Javier Bardem character, he reminded me of a cat. You guys are from Istanbul.
We know many cats.
There are many cats here. What do you say to this observation?
Oh, I know what you mean. This is something you do. You started that with Gossip Girl. You call Chuck Bass a cat. So that's your thing. Every time when a person and when a human character acts like a psychopath, it's a cat. I think you feel bad that you like the character, so you wanna make it cute.
When we were going through what this podcast was going to be like with Doruk, Jaren told him that at some point we always find a way to talk about Gossip Girl.
Exactly. I was thinking to that moment as she was speaking.
Really, I missed that. But usually it's Gilmore Girls.
Yes. Usually it's Gilmore Girls. You're confusing the girls. Well, I like girls. That was a deep cut Tarantino reference that nobody but Nissan got. But okay, Tarantino was on the Howard Stern program, and he was defending Roman Polanski. He said anal rape of 13-year-olds is okay because he likes girls. Tarantino's opinion on this.
Aaron and Doruk thought that was not funny that you were joking about this.
No, I was trying to figure out the reasoning.
No, he likes girls. Some people like girls. He likes girls.
So it's okay to rape children then, because he likes girls.
Okay. Let's go to Tarantino's house. It's amazing.
Okay, so the cat thing, more comment?
He has a cinema.
Does he have a cat, though?
Tarantino?
Tarantino. Does Tarantino have a cat?
I have no idea.
He might have a women's feet collection, but I'm not sure about the cat.
A women's feet collection?
Ew.
Does he cut off women's feet and collect them in his house?
Maybe.
He likes feet. The acting in this movie was fantastic.
Perfect segue.
I'm like, no.
Javier Bardem at some point took out his socks. Yes! So that's your segue.
Oh,
Shot for Tarantino.
Yeah.
All right. No. The actors all were great, right? Or was there any actor in this who you didn't like?
No, everybody was rock star.
What was everyone's favorite performance? Mine was Javier Bardem.
I'll second that. Yeah.
Yes. I wanted to give another answer, but
okay. Give a second best. Woody Harrelson.
They were all great.
What did you think about Whitey from One Tree Hill?
I recognized him immediately. You didn't?
Yes, Whitey from One Tree Hill was in this. I don't know if you guys watched One Tree Hill.
Nope.
How do you find the time to watch all these bullshit series?
Breakfast. So, One Tree Hill has a character. He's called Whitey. He's the basketball coach, and you keep expecting him to grope his students. It's a terrible character. The acting is awful. Whenever he's on screen, you cringe. He was the old guy who Tommy Lee Jones visited. He was great, right?
Oh, yeah.
What a phenomenal actor.
Yes, probably you can't act that well in a soap with the working conditions.
Well, Chad Michael Murray can.
No, not really.
In One Tree Hill, he's like an 80-year-old guy who's called Whitey.
Yes. Yes, yes, yes. So
yeah, but I would also say Javier Bardem, but he also had like the best role.
Yeah, no, everyone was really good. I think Thanos, was it? An okay shit protagonist. He probably had the most thankless role to play. Tommy Lee Jones, solid, rock solid.
Right? I think I like the best the scenes between Tommy Lee Jones and his deputy. Yeah.
Yeah.
Those two had like a great dynamic. The dialogue was amazing. Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah, dialogue and humor, I think, in general, like the deadpan delivery of everything was incredibly funny. So Tommy Lee Jones, yeah, he narrated this. He was sort of like a secondary protagonist or the actual protagonist, but he didn't do anything.
He didn't do shit.
Yeah, it was like told through his eyes, but he was like, this is like the way German Krimis work. Right now, English language film enthusiasts have discovered what they think is German creamy, and they are referring to the Edgar Wallace films from the late 50s and early 60s from Germany, which were precursors to the, like, they directly led to the giallo, because in Germany they ran out of money. They started producing in Italy, where Umberto Lenzi overtook those productions, and he was like one of the foundational directors of giallo, which then went to travel to America and turned into slasher movies. So that comes all from there. So people think, oh, there's a great German film tradition that we don't talk about. Right now, if we in Germany talk about creamy movies, we mean very gray, very dull procedural dramas that they air every Sunday on TV. And in that also we have they will have protagonists like the policemen, and they will do nothing and just be like sort of standing on the side of the drama, and we will look through their eyes at what is happening, and they are never in peril, they are never doing anything, they are never really emotionally involved. I think that really, really doesn't work. But since we don't
are they a couple days away from retirement?
Sometimes, yes.
I think it was deliberate in this one, though. I mean,
yeah, I loved it in this. I loved it in this. Yeah, like usually, I'd say I hate that narrative thing, but yeah, but why does it work? Why does it work in this?
I mean, I think it does, because it goes back to the same point about, you know, No Country for Old Men, that, you know, things have passed for Tommy Lee Jones. He is the one that's following, but he can never really intervene in that crime. It's so past him. I think the narrative disconnect between whatever's happening and Tommy Lee Jones and his deputy just following up 3-5 steps behind is a meaningful way of also highlighting that, you know, his time has passed, his prime has passed. He can no longer catch up with whatever's happening in terms of, you know, both the drug cartel and Javier Bardem's psychopathy and everything else that's happening in the movie.
So since you're saying that, No Country for Old Men and the theme of like an older generation being taken over by a new generation. So it's basically like the silent generation passing the torch to the baby boomers. And there's a scene, you pointed that out before, between Tommy Lee Jones and another sheriff, right? And what are they saying again?
Yeah, the one of the quotes I like from that is they were talking about how, you know, the new types of crime, the new generation. They also talk about, I think, someone with a punk appearance, like green hair with piercings. And one of the quotes that they have is, I think they say something around, it's a dismal type. It's a dismal tide. It comes in a tide. It's not one thing. It's a tide of different things happening, and then it just washes over them, floods them, basically.
So I am going to do something very millennial right now. I am going to problematize this movie, because if we interpret it that way, and I think that's a very valid interpretation, then what it basically says is there is this new generation. Some of them are Mexicans, foreigners. Some of them are punks. And then some of them, and this is clearly equated in, for example, that scene, are psychopaths who go around killing people just for killing. Not like the generation before that. And like this being the boomers is pointed out by scenes like when again and again dialogue revolves around the shit protagonist being a Vietnam veteran. So these are the people who take over, and what they are associated with is not what we associate them with now. Like now we see the boomers as leftovers from a racist era. No, they are seen as horribly progressive, which they were, as punks and minorities and psychopaths.
Where are the women again?
Not in this movie. It's a No Country for Old Men.
Yeah, and women are hiding in El Paso.
And then killed anyway.
Yeah.
Yes.
At least they are no princesses that are being saved. They are princesses that are not being saved.
Yeah.
Everyone dies.
Coen brothers.
Women dies too.
Women can die too. Yes.
They can do everything these days. No, but like is this like a regressive movie that is about how the changing of the tides is a horrible thing?
Well, the Mexican change comes with their own coke, and old men can't catch up with the coke-powered teenagers.
It's not coke. They call it the Mexican brown stuff, so that should be heroin. Do not snort brown powder.
Okay, I won't.
Okay, since we have that out of the way.
Do we even know that the Mexicans are the drug cartel? Because,
well, yes, Mexicans, they are drug dealers, they are rapists, we know that.
No, but like in the movie, it's shown.
See, Trump's secret agent is laughing his ass off. He wrote that line.
No, what I mean is, in the movie, are they not maybe just the people who brought it? We don't know the bosses behind.
We do actually know the boss.
Cartel?
We do know the boss. The guy in the skyscraper.
Is that guy the boss, or is he the DEA? That's what I was confused about, because at some point in the movie they talked about a DEA agent going to the field to explore, which I thought was.
Woody Harrelson.
Yes,
but Javier Bardem went into the office of his boss and shot him. I don't remember it clearly.
Also with the other guy who says, "I'm just a
yes
accountant." Yes.
So I thought that it was made clear that they are like in on the drug deal. I think because he says to the boss. You only send one weapon after like what you want, and I think
the right
that
tool
meant,
for the job.
Yeah, so that means that guy had sent Javier Bardem, and he was then angry that someone else had been sent too.
That's true.
Okay, I really thought it was open, like it was also another not important mystery.
Yeah.
Who is like the behind the drug cartel?
But would that mean that this movie is not regressive?
No,
So is this a conservative movie?
No. No.
Is it a progressive movie, though?
No. I don't see it as like a political statement.
All art is political.
Yes. No, I Okay, I thought I understood like the drug cartel. Everybody is. It's the Americans. It's the Mexicans.
But no. What I mean is, the good guys were the old people, and the old people were constantly telling each other that they don't understand these new times of young people who are psychopaths, sadists, and foreigners, and punks. So that was kind of equated in some of the scenes. So that thinking about it strikes me as conservative.
Yeah. Yeah, you make a point. Let me think about that.
Okay, let me jump in. I think it was quite interesting in the way that, you know, if we accept the main protagonist, the silent protagonist, as Tommy Lee Jones' character, the old man. He actually decides not to get involved. It's not just that he's behind the killer. He also doesn't want to get involved. You have a scene where his deputy is going in with the gun at the beginning of the movie, and he says, you ask Tommy Lee Jones, are you going to take your gun out? He says, I have you to protect me. So he goes after him, observes, doesn't get really involved. And then at the end of the movie, he chooses to retire. He doesn't want to face off with the young generation or the psychopath or whatever it is that we're talking about. I found that quite interesting in the way that the actual narrator and the protagonist of the movie is a silent observer but doesn't really want to get involved in it, which he had his change of heart once he went back at the final scene, at the final crime scene, where he goes into the hotel room where there has been a shootout. We know Javier Bardem is there. He goes in, but again, they don't face off. He leaves. And he's relieved that he's not been shot. I mean, I don't know what to make of it, but I thought that was a very interesting decision to not have them face off. And then the character retires and basically...
Nothing happened.
Yeah, nothing happened.
Yeah, no, but that's actually, yeah. Again, kind of...
He comments on that too, right? Like he chooses to be not involved, and that's good. But then... nothing happens, and that also makes like something with him.
But like, yeah, he also visually, as you say, for example, in that one scene, takes a step back behind the new generation and decides not to get involved and let them sort it out themselves. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if the movie says it does get sorted out, like it sort of peters out, but it's interesting because that's the one thing the boomer generation just won't ever do. Just take a step back and say, this is not my place anymore. This is not my world anymore. I don't understand it anymore. I'm not part of this anymore.
But so, also, technically, all the young people died.
Right. That whole new generation was murdered. But I mean, there were lots of boomers, so no shortage of them.
There was also, in the end, a new generation. There were kids who helped the psychopath.
Yeah, that was the Generation X.
Oh.
They were saved. They went home to smoke some joints and watch MTV. Cormac McCarthy wrote the book this whole thing is based on. And I'm so interested in Cormac McCarthy. Like, I've not read any of his stuff. He keeps popping up in... You've read Cormac McCarthy?
I read The Road, which is pretty good.
Oh, do talk about it. Because he keeps popping up in lists of like most disturbing books, most violent books. And they seem to be, most of them seem to be sort of Western related and really, really gritty. What would you describe
the
style?
I can't generalize. The Road is, I wouldn't call it gritty. Or maybe it is. Like, it's not Western at all. It's not, you know, disturbing writing. It's just great narrative book.
What is it about?
It's about a boy and his father walking through a post-apocalyptic US.
Have you seen the adaptation with Viggo Mortensen?
Yeah.
Is it good?
Yeah, I read it after the movie, so good.
Is it a better adaptation than No Country for Old Men, or a better movie than, or is it on par, or which is better?
It's a better movie than this, definitely.
Really?
Yeah. Because it has a climactic ending.
I mean, I need to stress, I did find this excellent, and I think I'm even on board with the climactic ending. Let's talk briefly about the decision not to show the shootout. So we have the protagonist. It's about him all the time. It's really tense at moments. We get so much tension out of him. And then he gets shot off camera, which I thought was kind of brilliant, because showing him dying would have given him like a heroic climactic moment. Having that play out off camera made it just a random killing on the side, which again...
He died because he fucked up, basically.
He just died, I think. It again feeds into this Coen brothers philosophy. People just randomly die.
Yeah, and you're also seeing him, it's from Tommy Lee Jones's eyes. We're actually at that point, Tommy Lee Jones trailing behind and he doesn't see what's happening. He just sees what has happened. He sees the Mexicans get in the truck and leave. And that's also one of the reasons why I think.
And also the other characters we see that they die, that they are being murdered by the psychopath. But I'm thinking of it. I think all of the murders we didn't see. They didn't show how they died.
Yes. The boss guy.
But like the main characters, Woody Harrelson, we only see Woody Harrelson's perspective. Josh Brolin's wife, we didn't see it at all. So it was everything was very elegant.
And they had such a good way of making clear that the wife had died. Like he looked at his shoes, and before that, this had been a theme, an ongoing theme in the movie of people not wanting to step into blood. So yeah, you're right. The boss guy, I think, was an exception. They showed him die. He watched him die. He died quite horribly, choking on his own blood. But yeah, that was... There's so much like thinking about it. There's so much attention to detail.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So much to appreciate here. So I think I will think about this a bit more. Jaren, do you have a favorite quote?
I do. I have two. I can't decide. But the second one is funny in the context. Okay, I'll tell you the least funny one. There's falseness in his voice. The mother-in-law yells behind the phone.
Yeah, that was
to the protagonist.
Funny.
But it's not funny when you say it like this. But Tommy Lee Jones says old age flattens a man, which I think fits this movie.
You feel that, right?
Yeah, because he doesn't do shit.
That is true. Okay, so then last we talk about the term of the week. We did have some ideas in the beginning of the shows. Did anything stick? Do any of you have a term of the week?
What was the term again? Pessimistic what?
Pessimistic Western.
Oh, yeah. Pessimistic Western or post-Western. I like both, actually.
Post-pessimistic Western, maybe.
Maybe.
Could we
think of others?
What's post-pessimism?
Nihilism.
So nihilistic Western.
But it's always cool to say post. Also because it's sort of a post-Western, you know?
New post-pessimism.
Us post-pessimism.
Us?
The true. The original.
I know what that means. It's one of my five Turkish words. So us post-pessimistic Western is what we settle on. I hope we can make a letterbox list with more movies that fit into this new category. We keep getting better at all our categories. No, we keep getting worse at all the categories. But whatever, that was it for this week. Let's just quickly look at what we're going to watch next week. Jaren, you have it there?
I think if we can make it, we'll do the Blade trilogy.
Fucking Blade trilogy. We've also already watched Blade 1 and hint hint, didn't love it, but I'm sure it's gonna be a fun episode, even though it's not gonna be a fun experience watching parts 2 and 3, but let's see about that. Maybe it will be. Doruk, thank you so much for the perspective of the simple man.
Thank you very much for having me. I hope more simple men will join your show.
We're so happy to have been brought closer to the people. That was it for this week. Thank you so much for listening, everybody. Bye.
Bye.
Goodbye.
Bye.